This is the Medic Cast, December 6th, 2010.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medic Cast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. We have a good show coming up for you, and I know it's been a week since we've put a show out here, and I want to make sure we get programming back in schedule here. Do want to remind all of you to make sure you head over and check out the MedicCast episode site. You can find a lot of great information over there, including links to everything discussed in each of the episodes in the show notes link right at the top of the page. But there are additional articles and information posted over there, news items and things like that, that you'll find on a weekly basis. And I urge you to follow up on that information. You can find all of that over at medicast.com/blog. So check out that information. Also, don't forget, you can always leave a comment there on the blog. Any of the articles, leave a comment for me. Anytime you leave a comment, it sends me an email, and I love to get those. You can also, of course, comment back and forth between you and other readers at the site. And it's a great way to continue to grow the MedicCast community, and I consider all of you part of that community. You can always, of course, send me an email. Shoot those emails in to podmedic@mac.com. And don't forget the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. Send those voicemails in. I love to hear from you. It's been a while since we've had one, so let's call in this week. If you have a comment on this week's episode, or you'd like to make a suggestion or a comment about the show in general, we're wrapping up our fifth year here, getting ready to head into year six here at the MedicCast, and I'm very excited about that as we head into 2011. So tell me what your thoughts are about the past year in EMS or about the show in 2010. I'd love to hear from you. If you are watching the video version of this podcast, I want to, first of all, thank you for doing that. You may be watching this on the website. Of course, you can find all the video episodes over at the MedicCast blog, but you may also be watching it on something like a set-top TV box, like a Roku box, Google TV, or something like that. And if you are, hey, welcome to the show. And if you're watching that way, shoot me an email and let me know when you got your device, how you found the MedicCast on there. Of course, it's part of the ProMed Network channel on those devices with all the other great programming at the ProMed Network, both audio and video. But you can, of course, find all of that there. Or if you're watching on the website, for those of you that haven't watched the video episodes of the show, you may want to check it out. I made it easy for you. Just go to medicast.tv, and that'll show you all of the video content that I post over there, including the weekly episodes and all the short segments that you may be looking for. That's it. We will be moving on here in just a second. Don't forget, though, you can find me on Twitter and Facebook, twitter.com/podmedic, facebook.com/podmedic. And if you haven't done it yet, get over to Facebook and become a fan of the MedicCast. It's a great way to follow up on additional information. I post questions over there for the listeners, additional links. Sometimes you get the episodes a little early. And so I would urge you to check that out. You just go to Facebook.com/MedicCast, and then click the like button right at the top of the page, and then that'll become part of your Facebook feed. You'll be able to see when there's updates posted there, questions from me and from other listeners, and you can, of course, correspond back there on the wall at the Facebook fan page. So check it out over at Facebook.com/MedicCast. We're going to jump in now to our listener mail, and I have a few pieces of email I picked up this week. Of course, when you send me an email, I do try to make sure I get back to you at least in a short email to let you know I got your email. And I can't always read every email here on the show, but I do respond back to you. So make sure you are sending those emails in to podmedic@mac.com. I got an email in from a listener, Peter. Now, he's a teenage EMS provider or member of a organization and community. And his teens in emergency services program has people working with community members and members of local services to teach them about these things, teach them about EMS and response and everything else. He was shocked, though, to find out that when providers are going on calls, that they aren't wearing their seatbelts. Now, he was interested because they wear their seatbelts in their private lives, but for some reason, when they jump into that emergency vehicle, a lot of them don't buckle up. And he found it absurd and really just very unusual. And I thought I would agree with you. I am amazed, and it's a problem because it's not just in your area, Peter. I've seen it in other locations, including my own local services. For some reason, the EMS providers and firefighters somehow think they're immune when they're riding that emergency vehicle. Like somehow the light bar and the siren is going to protect them from this the impending crash. Well, you know, the number one killer of EMS providers every year is not attacks from family members or working in dangerous areas like inner city environments. It's motor vehicle accidents, preventable injuries, I think, in many parts, because if the providers would wear seatbelts, at least in the front of the ambulance, they could better protect themselves. And of course, they're still working on a useful systems in the back of the ambulances that providers will wear to secure themselves safely in the back of an ambulance. But at least while riding in the front seat of an ambulance or a chase car or something like that, you should be wearing your seatbelts. And Peter, I appreciate you bringing this up because it's a big issue. I'm curious, are any others of you that are listening or watching the show having this issue? Do you wear your seatbelt, but the other people that you ride with don't? In my service, it's required. You must, if you're in the ambulance and its wheels are turning and you're riding up front, you have to be wearing a seatbelt. If you're riding in the back, we urge you to wear a seatbelt. But of course, patient care comes first. Now, that's kind of a gray area, and a lot of people just opt not to wear a seatbelt back there. But we don't want to get into an argument at this point. We're trying to come up with a solution that works for everyone. But we're going to probably start mandating it there, too. So what are your systems doing? Is there a requirement to wear your seatbelt? And is it monitored and enforced? I'd love to hear back from you. So just like Peter did, send in an email, podmedic@amac.com, or better yet, call in on the voicemail line and leave a comment about seatbelt use in your service. Peter, thanks for your email. Got another quick email in from listener Chris. Chris has been sending me links, and I really enjoy getting those links. He sent me a link on some issues in Idaho on EMS and how they need to shape up their system. And actually, Chris, I'm going to be featuring at least one of those articles in a future episode here, maybe in a week or two. So I want to thank you, though, for sending in those links. You know, I do news searches for information going on in EMS, but what's important to you? What's going on that catches your eye? If you find a link to something, don't just assume I've seen it and thrown it out. Send me the link. Of course, I want to feature and talk about things that are important to you. So if you have a link, send it in to me. I'll take a look at it, and at least I can send you a quick couple of comments back by email. If not, go ahead and feature the link in the news that week in the MedicCast. So I want to thank Chris for sending that in, and I urge the rest of you to send in those types of things as well. And Chris, thanks a lot for that. Finally, I got an email from listener Lucas. Lucas has been checking in with me about transferring his provider status from someplace like Canada to the United States, and how difficult or easy is it to do that. This is a big problem as people are trying to become qualified in one country and would like to be portable to others. We're finding, and leaders from around the world are seeing this, we're finding that there's just not an easy way to translate our experience and our protocols and our education from one place to another. What is the equivalent level of a paramedic in the United States when paramedics are all, it's the only name used in Canada, for instance, and then they have paramedics and then an intermediate level paramedic and then a critical care paramedic level. The same thing in other countries where paramedic may be used interchangeably for all levels of EMS service with different things that come after that, like critical care or advanced care or something like that. What do you think could be done about this? We're hoping, I think, based on some of the discussions held at the International Roundtable for Community Paramedicine this year in Vail, which I went to back in August, there was a lot of discussion about this, is how do you make your provider standards compatible and useful and transferable across national boundaries. One of the things that was discussed was there needs to be a common nomenclature, or at least a database that can say, a critical care paramedic in this country is the basic equivalent to this level of paramedic or this level of care provider in this country. And their skill sets are all the same with the exception of this, this, and this. So you could say, all right, this person can do everything we can do, but they are using LMAs or a King Airway or something like that for airway management. They are not ET tube trained. So what's that mean? Well, it means you could hire this person. They could be very qualified. You could interview them and find out what they know, give them a, you know, get them set up with your protocol system, and then come up with a way with your state and your national services registry, for instance, the national registry, to have a way to transfer in those qualifications with additional training. So someone would have to do an intubation airway management training class with somebody like this. These are just some ideas I'm throwing out there. What are your thoughts? I'd love to hear back from you. And this is why we do the listener email segment here on the show. I want to hear your comments back, just like Lucas sent in his comments. I'd like to hear yours as well. So send those emails in, podmedic@mac.com, or call in on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. Call in on the voicemail line and let us know what you think about these episodes. Time to jump on into this week's news segment, and I will talk about a couple of articles here. First off, starting off with a news item that I picked up from, it looks like it's My Southwest Georgia, MySSouthwestGA.com, so that's from Georgia. But as the Thanksgiving holiday wound down last week, and of course a lot of you realize I didn't have a show last week, so those of you that follow my Facebook page found out that my father was in the hospital, and just the complication of running back and forth to the hospital and, of course, the normal family and work complications, I was unable to get a show together. I tried and tried, and just every time I'd sit down and record, something else would come up. The phone would ring. So I appreciate you putting up with that. I don't miss many shows in the course of a year, but this, I think, was the first one, actually, in 2010. So I want to thank you for putting up with that. Do want to just check out this article, though. From Albany, Georgia, a local Baptist church, I'm looking here at the article, the Gillianville Baptist Church actually had a day where they brought in local emergency services responders, police, fire, and EMS, to recognize them and thank them for their service for the course of the year. And this is one of those things that I really like to see because it gives us an opportunity to interact with the public in a way that we don't often get to do, where we're often holding different sessions at our stations. Maybe we're teaching CPR classes. Of course, we're always in people's homes for a variety of reasons when they call us. But how often do we get an opportunity to just be invited to partake in some just community fellowship with members of our local area? And so I like to see these kinds of things. A couple of churches in my region have done something similar to this, had like a spaghetti dinner and invited our local company in. I think it's fantastic. I think it's nice to feel like we're wanted. But more importantly, and those of you listening to the show know where I'm going with this, it's great to have an opportunity to talk to people face-to-face about what we do and how we do it. Do they really understand how our system operates? You know, when you get invited to something like this, offer an opportunity to say, hey, could we have 15 minutes to talk about what our plans are for the next year and how we've planned to help service the community better? You might be able to set up a situation where you can actually have a follow-up church hall meeting. I know a lot of churches will have you in for a service, perhaps, and then afterwards there's a reception. There could be an opportunity for one of you to get up and talk about, hey, you know, over the next year, we're going to be teaching CPR classes every second Saturday of the month or something. Perhaps you can talk to them about some local speaking opportunities if they want somebody to come in and talk to their women's group or their men's group about chest pain, stroke, patient care, long-term care opportunities, collaborations with the local hospital and social services organizations. These are opportunities for you to do that. So I love to see this. I would love to hear how many of the rest of you have had local churches or civic organizations have a dinner or a recognition event for you and the other responders in your community. I'd like to hear back from you about that. But I saw this article and I thought I would bring it up. So I hope you appreciate that. And of course, I'd urge you to follow the link and check out what they did. It's kind of neat. Just a real quick kudos out to a group of North Carolina paramedics, really excited to see what was going on. Let me just get rid of something. Don't you hate pop-up windows? Had a pop-up window come up right in front of the article while I'm trying to look at it here. Three paramedics from Surry County, North Carolina, were the winners in the International Trauma Life Support Competition in Nevada last month, where they competed against an international group of paramedic contestants. And they had to assess a patient and appropriately treat a patient in a rapid treatment scenario where they didn't know what they were getting into when they started, and it was an opportunity for them to show off their skills. And I was excited to see something like this. Of course, the GEMS games are going on here in another couple of months at the EMS Today competition. You can find out information about that over at GEMS.com. EMS Today will have those GEMS games, and it's an exciting way to kind of put together a team from your service and compete against other services. And if for no other reason, then it's just fun to do. So check that out, and I would be interested, do you do something like this locally? You know, this would be a great opportunity to foster some cooperation between mutual aid agencies where you can have a friendly competition on a Saturday afternoon followed by a dinner. It's just a nice get-together and, again, an opportunity. The more we work together, the less likely there are to be complications and problems when you have those large-scale events where you need to be working together seamlessly. It's good to know, hey, I know that they can do this. I can leave this patient with them. I can move on, or we can work together because we have done so in the past and practiced together in the past. So look at something like this as an opportunity, not just on an international competition scale, but how about bringing it down to your local level and having a competition within your own company, and then a competition between neighboring companies and in your county and in your state. You know, it'd be a lot of fun. And again, it fosters that camaraderie and gives people an opportunity to see what other systems locally are doing to solve problems that you've solved. Different companies do different things when they're treating common problems, you know, splinting techniques, different equipment. So check out what they're doing. And you can find this link also in the show notes. Finally, an article from Edmonton, Alberta in Canada, the paramedic union there, talking about the increasing demand on the emergency services system up there, that as the hospital ER wait times continue to increase, that more and more people are turning to calling 911, thinking that it will get them in faster. We hear that all the time. I know you do as well. But is this really going to be a long-term solution? We haven't talked about overcrowding in the ERs and systems backing up, but now we're firmly getting into the flu season now. People with those respiratory problems are starting to ramp up. People that have to deal with weather, while in the summertime they might be more apt to take themselves to the hospital, now they don't want to go out on the icy roads or in the bad weather, and they want someone to come take care of them. I'm not downplaying that. You know, that is important. But we need to come up with solutions for our systems that don't always require a couple things. Don't always require transport. Okay, I know that, you know, that's a bad word. You know, it's not something we should be saying, refusal. And I'm not saying get needless refusals. I'm not saying that. I don't think that you should be talking people into refusal if they really want to go to the hospital. But you get those calls where people go, I wasn't sure what I should do. It kind of frightened me. Now I feel a little bit better. You know, work with your medical control, with your medical director, and within your protocols, but come up with a way that will give patients an opportunity to refuse responsibly and in an informed way, with the option that, hey, you can call us back 5 minutes from now. Ultimately, it saves you maybe another transport or two a month to the hospital. And that can be a huge thing when you're looking at services around a whole area all feeding into one central hospital. So I would urge you to just think about how you can cut down on numbers of needless transports. And again, I would caution you, I'm not saying this because the patients are abusing the system. Yes, there are people who abuse the system. I get it. But largely, people call 911 because they're frightened and they have an emergency. If they just watched a show about strokes on the local public broadcasting channel and they have a headache an hour later, guess what? They think they're having a stroke. Well, they're not. Or maybe they're not. But you can come in and help them to accurately assess what's going on. Talk to the local hospital. Do they really need to come in? How severe is it? Are there any other symptoms going along with that headache? then you can help them make an informed decision about, well, maybe it is just a headache. I'm going to monitor it and call if it gets worse or call if this change happens. And again, that needs to be done within your protocols and with your medical controls approval and your medical director's understanding of how you're going to go about this. But this is something that needs to be built into our systems so we're not tying up resources needlessly. We can assess patients in their homes and then help them make an informed decision about whether they really need to go to an emergency room or could they wait and go to a minute clinic at a CVS pharmacy or a Target or someplace like that the next day where they can go and get a quick checkup for a known price and it'll be a lot cheaper than thousands of dollars spent in the emergency room. That's it. These articles are available, again, over at the MedicCast blog, mediccast.com/blog. Check it out and then go ahead and click the show notes link at the top of the page and you'll be able to find the most recent episode at the top and you can scroll down and find the episode you're looking for below that. Go ahead and check these articles out and follow up on them in your own way. And again, thanks for checking out this week's news on the MedicCast.
It's that time again, and it's time for this month's segment with Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Jamie.
So what are we going to be talking about this month?
Well, Jamie, if you remember, back in November of 2008, I did a segment on pediatric cough and cold medicines, talked about their toxicity and also information on regulatory actions that occurred at that time. So I'd like to revisit that subject with some new data, some new studies that have come out since then.
Great.
First, a little background. From 1990 to 2006, as many as 10% of children in the United States were given cough and cold medicines weekly for illnesses and cold-like symptoms, allergies. A few years ago, a group of physicians petitioned the Food and Drug Administration to relook at the safety of these pediatric cough and cold medicines. Now, what prompted this was the fact that there were more than 60,000 possible poisonings reported to poison centers yearly, coupled with the lack of any data whatsoever that these products were effective in small children. So in 2007, soon after the petition, manufacturers actually stepped up and withdrew over-the-counter cough and cold products that were marketed for children less than 2 years of age. In 2008, the FDA recommended that cough and cold products not be used at all in children under two. Also in 2008, manufacturers went further in response to public pressure, and they actually changed the labeling of their products to indicate that they should not be used in children less than 4 years of age. And the FDA soon after supported that action. So here's the update. A study was published in the Annals of Emergency Medicine in 2009 that looked at pediatric fatalities associated with over-the-counter cough medicines reported by five sources, including poison centers. They looked at these fatalities over a period of at least 20 years. Different sources used different time frames. And they took it up to the point in time that the actions were taken on those products. There were 118 deaths in children less than 12 years of age that were concluded to be possibly due to the cough and cold medicines. Although there's been thousands of exposures, this really is a relatively small amount of children that have died from cough and cold medicine, so it really is not a common occurrence. Most of the fatalities that did occur were in children less than two. 88 of the deaths involved an overdose of the medicine, and most of the rest involved giving the child more than one product with the same ingredients. Unfortunately, many of the overdoses were when adults gave the children cough and cold medicines to sedate them or to control their behavior, so they really weren't using them appropriately. So this sheds a little more light on pediatric fatalities with cough and cold medicines, how many have occurred, why they've occurred prior to those regulatory and voluntary actions. The FDA is currently still reviewing whether to recommend more restrictions on the labeling of over-the-counter cough and cold medicines. Now, some in governmental agencies, as well as toxicologists and other experts, have raised some concerns that if we place more restrictions on cough and cold medicines for children, that actually might increase overdoses, might increase hospitalizations and severe outcomes by encouraging parents to give their young children products and doses that are intended for older children and adults. So unintentional overdoses by using products that really should not be given to small children. So Dr. Wendy Klein-Schwartz and Dr. Suzanne Doyon of our center, the Maryland Poison Center, along with Dr. David Sorkin of the University of Maryland School of Medicine, analyzed Poison Center data since the recall and these limitations took effect to see if this concern is a valid concern. Their research was published in the August 2010 issue of Pharmacoepidemiology and Drug Safety. What they found was that there was a greater than 50% decrease in the rate of cases of therapeutic dosing errors in kids less than two for the 15 months following the withdrawal that occurred in October of 2007, which, by the way, included a flu season that was more severe than in previous years. So you actually would think that there would be more opportunity for dosing errors because of more parents giving their children or wanting to give their children cough and cold medicines because of the flu that children were experiencing during that time. So there was no difference found in the rate of unintentional poisonings. That is, when children grab the bottle, they drink from it, or also there was no difference in poisonings with the products for any reason in the 2 to 5 year old age group. So this study suggests that products were still accessible to toddlers and still were being given therapeutically to slightly older children. So although concerns that restrictions would lead to more harms not support it, you know, it showed a decrease in these therapeutic or dosing errors, we still do have a little bit of a problem with kids getting into products. But the concern about more restrictions just doesn't hold up based on this particular study. Lastly, remember that your regional poison center is available 24/7 to assess and recommend treatment for all cough and cold medicine exposures in children. The number is 800-222-1222.
And I really like that, you know, the follow-up research is so important in these types of things because we really need to understand how these types of regulations and restrictions affect use after the fact. So it's great to hear that there's follow-up.
It's very important. You know, when you have an action like that, you do want to make sure that there's some result from that action. And also, in this case, when there might be more actions coming along down the pipeline, we want to make sure we're not doing anything to make the situation worse. So this is one study. You know, hopefully there'll be more studies to support this, but this one study shows that there's no concern about parents giving adult products to their children. I'm sure it does occur, but overall it doesn't seem to be a big problem. And I'll give you, Jamie, the exact references or citations for these studies. So if you can post them on your website, then the listeners could go to those actual articles and read the articles and read the research if they wanted to get more information.
I'll definitely do that. And it's nice to see, it seemed like also that the research supported the fact that there was a positive effect overall of this restriction because there were fewer calls coming in.
That's right. You know, again, the number of exposures in small kids where they accidentally grab a bottle didn't change very much because the adult products are still in the homes, and so kids do have access to them. So it didn't do a whole lot for that, but most of the severe poisonings and fatalities that occurred prior to the actions that were taken were actually when parents were giving the wrong doses to children and not when children got into the bottle on their own and drank from it. So, you know, when you put that fact together with the research that's been done past that or afterwards, after the actions, then you can see that it really has made an impact.
And it also stresses the importance when parents are sent home with any medication for their children that they receive the proper dosing measurement device, whatever that may be for that medication.
That's right. Sometimes parents are a little confused about how to use measuring devices, how to read them. Also, they don't read the labels, you know, and give the children wrong doses. Or sometimes they just think, well, it's an over-the-counter medicine. It must be safe, so I can give my child a little bit more and take care of his symptoms. So there are a lot of combinations of reasons why kids are being overdosed unintentionally on these products.
Great, Lisa. Well, we'll look forward to next month's topic, and thanks a lot for sharing all this great information with the listeners.
You're welcome, Jamie.
And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week. Again, I want to thank Lisa Booz for her excellent segments. She comes on here. We record these in advance, about four or so at a time. But Lisa does come up with some great stuff. And this review on pediatric cough and cold medications is an important one. If you're listening to this and you want to find out some more, I would urge you to head over and check out her stuff over at the Maryland Poison Center site or your local Poison Center site or phone service. And again, those numbers and information are available to you locally. But generally in the U.S. and parts of Canada, that number is 1-800-222-1222. And of course, the Maryland Poison Center site is available to anybody. You don't have to be from Maryland. You can go to mdpoison.com and check out the resources that Lisa and others provide over there. And again, I'm going to have a segment coming up here soon on the MedicCast TV short segment. We're kicking off another round of episodes for that show that comes out every Friday. And I'll be talking about pediatric dose measurements and having the appropriate tools and a little tip for EMS professionals. So you'll want to check that out. And that'll be coming out in an upcoming Friday in a few weeks. And you should check out those episodes. You can head over and find those over at MedicCast.tv. That's it. Don't forget to send me an email. You can catch me by email at podmedic@mac.com or call in on the voicemail line 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC, and leave a message of what you thought of this episode or suggestions for future episodes or maybe a correction. Hey, if I made a mistake, catch me on it. Leave those comments over there either by email or on the voicemail line. And of course, don't forget to keep up with me on Twitter and Facebook. You can find me under the handle PodMedic in most places. So that's twitter.com/PodMedic or facebook.com/PodMedic. And of course, check out the MedicCast fan page on Facebook, where you can get other information that gets posted there and only there throughout the course of the week. And you'll find that over at facebook.com/MedicCast. Just go ahead and click the like button right there at the top of the page. We will close out today's episode with first of our Christmas songs. Usually I kick that off the Sunday after Thanksgiving, but we didn't have a show last week, so we'll kick it off this week. A few weeks of holiday music. My holiday of choice this time of year is Christmas, so bear with me. I try to pick some good songs for you. You can check out this music. This is Jill Parr, one of my favorite Christmas songs. It's like a rocked out version of Do You Hear What I Hear? So I urge you to check it out. There's a link in the show notes to her music. And let her know you heard it here on the MedicCast. And support these musical artists. It's really great that they share this excellent music with us here on the show. And I really love to hear from them. So check it out here on the MedicCast. And you can find the links to Jill's site and music in the show notes. That's it for me. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. We'll be back again next week. Promise. We actually will be back again next week. No more skips for the rest of the year. We'll be going ahead and closing out the show. I do want to remind all of you to keep in mind the most important thing, because I want you to come back next week. Go ahead and remember, Scene Safety and BSI.